And our sermon text today is Song of Solomon, chapter 5, verses 2 through 8. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound. My beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh, on the handles of the bolt. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me. They took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. The idea of bearing a message of love and fidelity from one lover to another, it's a popular theme in music, isn't it? Especially rock and roll. It seems to be a rock and roll series to some extent, doesn't it? We illustrate from it quite often. The song Message to Michael by Dionne Warwick, 1966. The lyrics go, spread your wings for New Orleans, Kentucky Bluebird. Fly away and take a message to Michael. Message to Michael. He sings each night in some cafe in a search to find wealth and fame. I hear Michael has gone and changed his name. Oh, tell him how my heart just breaks in two since he journeyed far. And even though his dream of fame fell through, to me he'll always be a star. Message to Michael. And of course, I have one that's on my phone as Debbie's ringtone. And it's She Loves You by the Beatles. She loves you, yeah, 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 right? You think you've lost your love. Well, I saw her yesterday. It's you she's thinking of. And she told me what to say, right? A messenger between two lovers. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, in these and so many other cases, the idea is that for true love to continue, a personal message must be borne by a faithful messenger from one lover to another. How crucial for true love to persist in each of these relationships is that messenger or messengers. This is a motif echoed in our text today as the Shulamite girl, longing for her shepherd boy, lays a significant oath request upon the harem girls that they would put them in, the harem girls, in an immediate dilemma. And we'll unpack this a little more as we go through the text. But fulfill that oath request and contradict everything for which they stood in the harem, or deny it and break a legitimate solemn request by a covenant fellow, that is, another harem girl. Consequently, though we may read over this oath request rather quickly, there's more here than meets the eye, okay? More here than meets the eye. So let's go to our text here. 2 points I want to make with you as we come to this text. Number one, oath request. It's at the heart of our text today. In a discrete dream sequence, the Shulamite girl reaffirms her passionate love for the shepherd boy. Her passionate love for the shepherd boy. Now, we're coming off last week's text, where we saw Solomon, and you let your eyes graze over that previous text, chapter 4, first verse of 5. And we saw Solomon last week make a concerted effort at seduction of the harem girls and our heroine, the Shulamite girl, in particular. You remember, he did it through flattery. How beautiful you are, my darling, right? He did it through erotic promise. You'll feel all the feelings of love, passion, etc., right? And the social pressure of the harem girls, too. That was also present. You see that in the chorus just preceding. It's like, hey, girl, get with the program. Everyone is doing it, right? And we saw what a tremendous enticement Solomon's seduction presented to her. And as a direct correlation, really, to every girl of every generation being seduced by any culture that offers an alternative to the one man, one woman model of faithful covenant marriage. That's at the heart of Song of Solomon. Gee, I wonder if our culture does that, right? Alternatives to the one man, one woman covenant relationship. You need only open your email or your messaging or your newspaper to discover that that is precisely the case all through our culture. Well, eventually the Shulamite girl will triumph over all obstacles and lay before us her accumulated wisdom. In chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, and I want you to turn there now in your Bibles. This is a spoiler alert. She is successful. She does triumph. And distilled in verses 6 and 7 are her wisdom derived from her experience here. And once again, you must remember Shulamite, that's her nickname. That's not her, we don't know her real name, but her nickname. Is wise one, Shulamite. And we'll see next week, it's kind of a sarcastic name that the harem girls will give her. But as in so many cases, those sarcastic names end up sticking, don't they? And they become badges of honor. And the consonants for the Shulamite woman are the same consonants of Solomon's name, the wisest man who ever lived, right? Well, we are going to see that the consonants are the same as Solomon's name. The vowels, however, make us pronounce it Shulamite instead of Solomon. And she is the one who comes out as wise at the end. And you have distilled in verses 6 and 7, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. That is telling us that love is a covenant bond, the idea of a sign and seal. For love is strong as death, jealousy as fierce as the grave. And I give credit to Miles Van Pelt. He does really good work on Song of Solomon. He says, this is telling us the idea that love is as strong as death, jealousy is as fierce as the grave, is that love is rock hard. It's solid. It cannot be broken. Love's flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. These are the words of the Shulamite woman. That is, love is white hot. True covenant love is white hot. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. That is telling us that love overcomes obstacles. And she is overcoming obstacle after obstacle after obstacle, isn't she? That Solomon and the harem girls and culture of that day is throwing in her way. If a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. That's telling us that love cannot be bought out of the harem, right? The enticement of harem life is that not only do you get to frolic at least one night with this great lover, King Solomon, but even if he never calls you back into the bedroom, you've got a life of ease in the harem for the rest of your life. All the best clothes and perfumes and food, right? That's something, right? Or is it? Or is it? So this would be the accumulated wisdom that we'll see at the end. But she's right in the middle here and now. She's in what one of my professors calls the deep, dark tunnel of chaos. You don't know what's at the other end, where you're going to burst out. But in the meantime, you're in that deep, dark tunnel of chaos, and it's stressful. You don't know exactly what's going to transpire, but you must be faithful. And she is faithful. Now, I do this periodically in this series so that you better understand why we have concluded that our construction of the song is what it is. It helps make sense of our assertion that there is true dramatic tension between Solomon and the harem on one side and the Shulamite girl and her shepherd boy on the other side of the conflict. You don't get this in other constructions of the Song of Solomon. It's just the Shulamite girl and Solomon, and they're tumbling and rolling in their beds, right? And preachers have a hard time making sense of it and consequently never preach this book. But if you understand the inherent tension here between Solomon and the harem on one side and the Shulamite girl and her shepherd boy on the other, things begin to fall in place and make sense. So, it is to this that the Shulamite girl is struggling to come to. The Shulamite girl, a true biblical heroine, like Ruth or Esther or the Proverbs 31 woman. You remember in our opening, and I encourage you to go back and especially listen to the introductory sermon where we lay out the premise for the Song of Solomon, and then the previous sermons as well for background. I thank our deacon, Stuart, for getting those up online, and you can access those now, but especially the introduction, where we see that canonically Proverbs ends with a Proverbs 31 woman, right? A virtuous woman. Who can find? You find her laid out in her character and so forth in Proverbs 31. And then the next book is the book of Ruth. Might Ruth be a virtuous woman? Amen, right? Brian, a few years back, spent time with us preaching through Ruth and demonstrating that indeed she is a virtuous woman. And the next book is Song of Solomon. Might we have another virtuous woman here of the character of Proverbs 31? We're finding out indeed she is. And so, in answer to the powerful enticement of Solomon's rock concert seduction, we saw that last week, we have today a reaffirmation of her simple, passionate love for the shepherd boy. But unlike the sensuous, carnal pleasure of the harem, which is in blatant violation of the one man, one woman covenant marriage bond, instead of that, we have a discreet, even chaste way of showing that love. And that's the literary device of the dream sequence. Very important part of this text today. The idea of the dream sequence. If that sounds familiar, go back to chapter 3, verse 1, where she says, "On my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves." We see that's a consistent phrase all through the Old Testament, the idea of a dream. You're about to enter into a dream. "I sought him, but found him not." And then that dream sequence goes on in some detail to articulate the deep love and affection, which will only find real and complete expression when the covenant signs and seals have been exercised. That is, when the seal on the heart has been set, when the seal upon the arm has been set. That is, fast-forwarding us to chapter 8. So, that is the very clever device, the poetic device, literary device, very clever, of the dream sequence. It can express the love of the otherwise chaste couple without their violating a covenant bond, literally and physically. And it's what we have here. "I slept, but my heart was awake." Isn't that beautiful? That's poetry right there. "I slept, but my heart was awake." It's a perfect expression of a lover dreaming of her beloved. A sleeping body, an awake heart. The old black and white TV show, I Love Lucy. Some of you gray hairs may remember that, but has some classic comedy scenes. One of those has Lucy and Ricky in a discreet, for today it's discreet, but risque for then. This is back in the 50s. A discreet scene in which they're tucked in for the night, but in double beds. The censors wouldn't let you be seen in one single bed sleeping together. In double beds and in full head-to-toe pajamas, too. In which Ricky falls into a deep sleep and obviously begins to dream. You can tell by the expressions on his face. He's having a very pleasant dream. And he's hugging his pillow very affectionately, too. And Lucy smiles, a very contented smile, because she thinks at first that Ricky's dreaming about her. But then she realizes that Ricky has just hired an attractive singer for his Cuban music ensemble. And she begins to doubt whether he's actually dreaming about her. So she becomes very agitated and jealous and watches him for a long time. The comedy comes with the expressions that come across both of their faces. As Ricky smiles and hugs his pillow in various poses and expressions of pleasure, and Lucy's jaw drops and expressions of how dare you and great consternation come across her face. Not a word is said through the entire skit. The entire skit goes on for about 5 or 6 minutes until Lucy can stand it no longer and pokes him to wake him up and demands to know about whom he was dreaming. Now, just imagine that we were standing around Shulabeth's bed that evening, right? The evening of her dream, and watching the expressions on her face and how she was hugging her pillow, maybe. And parenthetically, she'd have every right to ask if she awakened, what in the world are you people doing around here? But if we were there then, we might come to the same conclusion. That she was dreaming of her beloved and the pleasure that he brought to her. We hear, first of all, the furtive voice of the shepherd boy asking for access to her presence from the outside, where he has sought her out in the night for some time now, the impression is, such that my locks, my head are wet with the dew of the night. Now, there's some irony here, and we're going to amplify this as we go through the text. But there's great irony in this situation, in that in the dream sequence, it is the covenant courtship of Shulamith and the shepherd boy, which is illicit and furtive and done on the sly under cover of night. While the seduction of Shulamith and the harem girls, one and all of them, right? This is done in broad daylight and with brazen regularity and normality. It should be the other way around. But under Solomon, evil is being called good, and good is being called evil. It'll be true in the humiliating beating scene that we'll see that is coming. And they say there's no drama in the Bible, right? Well, she receives him naked in her dream. I'd put off my garment. How could I put it back on? And she cannot go out to meet him, but must let him into her quarters. I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? And then verses 4 to 6 go on to describe her going to let her shepherd boy in the door. That's at one level. But there is deliberate and unvarnished double entendre here in the poetic language that is meant to communicate highly erotic lovemaking between the two. And it is some of the best, most skilled Hebrew poetry as well. Most skilled Hebrew poetry that we have. Since the vocabulary and phrasing can be used for both the ubiquitous mundane accoutrements of a house or the intimate sharing of the marriage bed. In any case, we are meant to see that there need be no loss of erotic pleasure in a covenant marriage. That's the upshot of this text. There need be no loss of erotic pleasure in a covenant marriage. It is designed to be rock solid and white hot, as Van Pelt puts it. There may be a measure of delayed gratification in its satisfaction. That's the genius of the dream sequence, okay? Telling us what will transpire in the future. And you parents, I've already warned you about this, right? We've got a warning on the erotic nature of this text. For those of you visiting, we've already counseled parents to go home and talk about this with your kids and explain this is maybe a time to have that talk, right, with your kids, because they're going to be asking all kinds of questions. But this is the genius of the dream sequence, that there's a measure of delayed gratification in the satisfaction of that erotic passion and pleasure. But once those covenant obligations have been fulfilled and signed and sealed in a covenant ceremony, watch out! It will be rock solid and white hot. But as our heroine discovers later in our song, her covenant love does overcome obstacles too. That is, many waters cannot quench love. And there's obstacles, some serious obstacles thrown in her way here. That brings us to point two. Oath request. In a discrete dream sequence, which is what we are in the middle of, in a discrete dream sequence, the Shulamite girl faces obstacles and lays an oath promise on the harem. The idea of the adjuration. Covenant is all through this text, all through this book. Now, the irony that we spoke of previously is highlighted here again and put in our face, so to speak. Still within the dream sequence, she's discovered by the watchman of the city and identified as one of Solomon's harem trainees. She is severely punished. She's physically punished. She's beaten and bruised. And she's humiliated as well. Her veil is taken away. And for a young virgin, especially in service to the king, this was an all but deal breaker. The implication is that she's now a common tramp. In fact, we know from Egyptian and Persian documents on harem life that both a harem girl and any stray dog caught sniffing around the king's harem could summarily be put to death. The harem, and this is one of the things we treat of in those early sermons, it's necessary to understanding this text is positing a harem, not just others. You know, ignore those headings in your translation because they're not in the text. They're not inspired scripture. They're just there positing a convenient identification, if you will. So just ignore those headings. Others, no, harem. Harem girls. The daughters of Jerusalem are the harem girls. Because the harem was both a shining symbol of a king's power and prerogative, and it was also the jealous source of great pleasure for him. Don't mess with anything that's the king's, especially his precious, the harem. Or else. Now this does have application. It has application through the centuries, I submit to you. Cultures and historical circumstances may change, but tyrannies never do in their essence. This is a tyranny. The impulse is always the same. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine. And don't mess with it or else. And we see this in our own day in many ways, but increasingly in the government ownership of our children, for example. You parents need to be on top of this. Our government schools, the government ownership of our children, these schools may not be harems in the pure sense, but government schools are increasingly laying claim to our children as property of the state. In 2013, for example, Melissa Harris Perry said on MSNBC, and I quote her, she's reflecting on government schools, she says, "We have never invested as much in public education as we should have, because we've always had a kind of private notion of children. Your kid is yours and totally your responsibility. We haven't had a very collective notion," all these words, these key words, right? "We haven't had a very collective notion of these as our children." So part of it is we have to break through our kind of private idea that kids belong to their parents or kids belong to their families and recognize that kids belong to whole communities, i.e. the state. Right? That was 2013. And that has just been put into warp drive since then, really. Consequently, our schools can administer vaccines or arrange an abortion for your child without telling you, or teach and suggest that your child may be transgendered and qualified to undergo gender change therapy without your permission. And all of this, of course, accompanied by the decades-long practice of substituting real education with indoctrination, such that Johnny may not be able to read his diploma when he graduates, but he'll vote progressive for the rest of his life. In many respects, we face the same tyranny in our schools that the Shulamith girl faced in the harem. Truth and right are inverted. In the law, punishment and sanction were invoked upon those who strayed from the one man, one woman covenant model of marriage. It is Solomon who should be beaten and humiliated for his transgression of the law. Instead, it is the tyranny of Solomon and the harem that punishes the law keeper, Shulamith. She transgressed the lawless, evil rules of a tyrant and was punished for it. I keep telling you, Solomon does not come off well here. If he's in some interpretations of this book, he's made to come off well in some way, shape, or form. They're just plain wrong, okay? Solomon transgressed the law of God and goes unpunished for the time being. For the time being. Because ultimately, men do not break God's law per se, but rather find themselves broken upon his law, like a wooden ship dashed to pieces on the rocks in a storm. Solomon will be broken upon God's law, we see in Kings and Chronicles. He descends tragically into sin and idolatry. The song is in part testimony to that descent. And then lastly, our Shulamith girl turns the tables on the harem girls yet again and lays a solemn oath upon them to relay a message to her shepherd boy. Once again, that's the sense of adjuration, that English term used in translation there has the idea of to law. In Hebrew, it has more reference to covenant. I lay a covenant obligation upon you to relay a message to her shepherd boy. If you find my beloved, tell him I am sick with love. She is wise. She is far more Solomonic than Solomon. The adjuration serves two purposes. Number one, if it is fulfilled, it will reassure and shore up a young man's heart who's perhaps wondering, there she is behind the harem walls. I can't get to her. I can't talk to her. He might be tempted to waver at the constancy of his true love. Is she still his? Has she been seduced by the blandishments of Solomon? Does she still love me? Right? Does she still love me? She loves you. Yeah. She loves you. That's the message they should be taking to him. But also, secondly, and this isn't always picked up upon, it also brings into stark, undeniable contrast the difference between a committed, unmovable heart and one that succumbs to ease and disobedience, like the harem girls. After all that has transpired, and there's more to come, the Shulamite girl is still sick with love for him, not Solomon. We should rejoice at this. And the harem girls, on top of it, are under covenant obligation to bring the message. They're in a true dilemma. Don't bring it and you violate your oath to your fellow harem girl. Do bring it and you expose your own sin and disobedience. Despite the seduction to which they have all fallen prey, Shulamith still stands strong. It is an implicit humiliation to them if they yet have any shame. So true, then, must every bride remain to her bridegroom. That is part of the message of Song of Solomon. Are you as faithful in your covenant obligations to your spouse as she is to him and he to her? And then, in the larger view of things, so true must be the bride of Christ to her bridegroom, her husband, Christ. As we have emphasized throughout, and as is meant to be applied, our marriages, men and women, model this relationship of covenant fidelity. And kids, as you're coming up, your marriage, you need to plan your marriage partners, your shepherd boy, if you will, to model this relationship of covenant fidelity. Because your marriage is indeed, as Paul says, the mystery of Christ and the church. You're modeling Christ and his church for the world. But this does not mean that you have no pleasure, that we are prudes. No, we in no way sacrifice any of the joy or intimacy of true love. Every Christian marriage can and should be rock solid and white hot, with able to withstand tests and trials. May that be your case today. Fathers, happy Father's Day. And may your marriages be rock solid and white hot in the days to come as well. Well, let's now come to that place where we see that intimate bond between Christ and his church, expressed in the body and blood of the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.